Welcome to Scott Bennett's Global Great Awakenings. I'm Jim Fetzer. It's my honor to fill in for Scott while he's in special assignment in the Ukraine. We'll even have a report from Scott later during the show. He's doing a terrific job there. Meanwhile, the luxury Swiss peace summit was a flop. To make peace, it's better to gather in a five-star resort equipped with all comforts. Western diplomacy loves luxury and the pleasures of life. To discuss peace between Russia and Ukraine, it was decided to hold the summit in increasingly less neutral Switzerland. The summit took place at the legendary Bergestock Resort in Lucerne, a little corner of paradise for the delegation present at the summit, stuffed for billionaires. Room stays cost between $1,500 and $2,000 per night per person. The Lucerne Resort covers an area of 10,000 meters squared, features three private spas, 15 treatment rooms, a fully equipped fitness area, an indoor swimming pool, and two outdoor, one of which is an infinity with breathtaking views of the Lake of the Four Cantons. The catering service is also enchanting. The rates to take advantage of international cuisine vary between $200 and $400 per meal. In short, if you have to play at making peace, it's better to do it with a full belly and maximum comfort. No harm done, therefore, if the summit was a gigantic flop. First of all, due to the absence of the Russian and Chinese delegations. What makes the noise above all is the fact that no member of the BRICS, of which Moscow is part together with Brazil, India, China, and South Africa, ultimately gave the green light to the final declaration of the Bergenstock Conference. In addition to the BRICS countries, Mexico, Indonesia, and Thailand also decided not to sign the text. In the end, Iraq and Jordan, with a joint note, also made it known they were withdrawing their signatures from the final document. Can that be considered the basis for future peace negotiations? Probably not. The main points of the paper are statement of principle that would amount to an unconditional surrender by Russia. It takes in no account of the military dynamics on the battlefield. The final communique was signed by 80 of 92 countries present at various degrees of representation. The other countries that do not appear on the list are Armenia, Colombia, the Vatican as an observer, Libya, Taiwan, and the United Arab Emirates. The three top institutions of the European Union appear on the list of signatories, but not other international organizations. So there's a list of those supporting the declaration. But when you notice that the two most populous nations in the world, India and China, did not sign, that Russia was not even invited to participate, it was misconceived from the beginning. Meanwhile, the Kremlin derides the outcome of the Ukraine talks held without Russia. Russia said Monday a Swiss-hosted conference on Ukraine had produced negligible results and showed the futility of holding talks without Moscow. The Kremlin was commenting on a weekend summit where Western powers and their ally denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but failed to persuade non-aligned states to join their final statement. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the results of the meeting, to which Russia was not invited, were close to zero. At a daily briefing with reporters, Peskov was asked if the fact that countries like Hungary, Serbia, and Turkey had taken part and signed the statement would spoil Russia's relations with them. No, it won't spoil them. We will, of course, take into account the position these countries have taken. That's important to us. We'll continue to explain our reasoning to them. Many, and this was a common point of view on this event, confirmed their understanding of the absence of prospects for any serious substantive discussions without the presence of Russia. If we talk about the overall effectiveness of this meeting, it is close to zero. Vladimir Putin said last week, Russia was willing to end the war, but he set out conditions for Ukraine, renouncing its NATO ambitions, withdrawing its troops from poor regions claimed by Russia. Kiev rejected his tantamount to capitulation. Of course, we understand perfectly that time will come when it will be necessary to talk to Russia, the Ukrainian foreign minister observed, but our position is very clear. We will not allow Russia to speak in the language of ultimatums like it's speaking now, ignoring the fact that the circumstances on the battlefield dictate that Russia is being very generous by restricting its decision to the land it already occupies, requesting Ukrainian troops to withdraw from those areas, to renounce its pursuit of NATO, and then to move on. Peskov said what he called Putin's peace initiative remained on the agenda, reaffirmed Moscow's position it was open to dialogue. State News TASS quoted Russian foreign intel chief Sergei Nayeshkin as saying on Monday, if Putin's conditions were rejected, they would be replaced by new and tougher terms. Well into the war's third year, Russia controls nearly a fifth of Ukraine and has advanced gradually on several fronts since February. More than 90 countries attended the two-day talks in Switzerland, but a decision by China to stay away all but assured the summit would fail to achieve Ukraine's goal of persuading major countries from the global south to join in isolating Russia. The summit final declaration called for Ukraine's control after the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant and its Azovstal seaports to be restored. But in line with the conference's more modest stated aims, it omitted tougher issues of what a post-war settlement for Ukraine might look like, whether Ukraine could join the NATO alliance, or how troop withdrawals from both sides might work. Meanwhile, Paul Craig Roberts, the ever-widening war. British foreign minister says, we must go after everything Russian. We will show Putin that we are completely behind Ukraine. We will chase the money and the oil. We'll stop the gas. We'll stop the ships, declared the Russian British Foreign Minister Cameron. The UK is hunting companies that do business with Russia all over the world, Cameron said. We will sanction companies in China, in Turkey, in Kyrgyzstan, even in Israel, that we believe are supplying dual-use material to Russia. This is the consequence of Putin's ill-considered limited military operation in Ukraine. It's extraordinary. Russian intelligence failed to inform Putin that a slow-poke war would permit the West to become involved, thereby turning it into a war between NATO and Russia. Putin still speaks of negotiating a peace with Ukraine despite the fact that Ukraine, NATO, and Washington have made it completely clear the only terms for peace are Russia's withdrawal from Ukraine, including Crimea, payment for damages and dead Ukrainians, and acceptance of NATO membership for Ukraine. One can only wonder at the complete lack of realism as the West brings war to Russia. Is it the Kremlin's plan to be a sitting duck and only respond defensively after Russia's attacked? Or has Putin issued a final warning? 2 days ago, he said the selfishness and the hypocrisy of the West have produced a dangerous situation, bringing the world close to the point of no return. Putin's words call to mind Serbian President Vučić's statement, the train has left the station and no one can stop it. Putin said it calls the Western leaders to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, which has the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons, demonstrate the extreme adventurism of Western politicians. They either do not understand the scale of the threat they themselves create, or they are simply obsessed with belief in their own impunity and their own exclusivity. Both can turn into a strategy. It's extraordinary that not only the Western world, but the entire world ignores the dangerous situation described by Putin. Why hasn't the UN imposed sanctions on Washington for provoking nuclear war? Why is it patriotic to promote war but not peace? I've been warning far longer than has Putin, and my reward has had to been called names and put on lists of Russian agents or dupes. A pending war could have been avoided if the West had abided by the Minsk Agreement, which kept Donbass in Ukraine, providing the two republics with some autonomy to stop Ukraine's attacks on the Donbass population. Putin supporting the agreement for 8 years despite continuing provocations. As the German Chancellor and President of France both admitted, the West only pretended to support the Minsk Agreement, while the West built a large Ukrainian army capable of subjugating the Donbass republics. Before intervening in February 2022, Putin and Lavrov made a last effort to negotiate a mutual security agreement with the West, but was cold-shouldered. Clearly, the West intended a conflict from the beginning. What was the West thinking? Why did Putin think Russia's intervention could be limited to Donbass? Putin watched Washington overthrow the Ukrainian government, insert a puppet, demonize and attack the Russian population of Donbass, refuse all Russian proposals to avoid conflict, and force Russia into protecting the Russian areas that had been attached to Ukraine by Soviet leaders. The West certainly knew that the Kremlin could not simply sit on its hands while the Russian population was massacred. In Putin's defense, perhaps he's too humane to comprehend the evil that has the West in its grasp. Perhaps his central bank director and Russian neoliberal economist told him Russia could not afford a war. Perhaps Putin thought the West would come to its senses. But the West hasn't come to its senses. The West is intentionally driving toward a war with Russia. As President Vučić says, no one is attempting to stop the war. Nobody is speaking about peace. Peace is almost a forbidden word. It is an extraordinary situation. As the late Stephen Cohen and I emphasized, once we saw the West fomenting the conflict with Russia, the situation is more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis. At that time, Washington understood the necessity of defusing tensions. Today, Washington intentionally worsens tensions, and there's no concern about the consequences. My conclusion? The West has lost touch with reality and is bringing death and destruction upon itself. Meanwhile, former U.S. officer Scott Bennett lists countries where Russia could send weapons. Former U.S. Army officer Scott Bennett, in a conversation with RT, listed countries where Russia could send weapons. Earlier, Russian President Putin, during his speech at the plenary session of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, said the Russian side reserves the right to supply long-range weapons to some countries in response to the West supplying Kiev, but has not yet done so. Bennett, when asked by RT which countries could be discussed, he replied, if he were the Russian leader, he would send weapons to Yemen as well as to Iran. Yemen! So absolutely all the American ships that are there in the zone are wiped off the face of the earth. Iran! So the American submarines in the Persian Gulf can be bombed. He continued that air defense system could also be sent to Venezuela and to Cuba. We have a video of Scott reporting on war crimes, which we're pleased to share with you now. Dong.
This is a legal affidavit, an oral affidavit. My name is Scott Bennett, former United States Army officer, State Department counterterrorism analyst, This is an affidavit testifying that the area behind me is the place that was struck, the apartment complex, the civilian housing structure that was struck by American and NATO weapons. These are civilian targets. These are not military targets. As such, this is an act of terrorism. This is an act of intentional terrorism meant, designed, and orchestrated to exercise political extortion upon the Russian Federation. As such, this is an act in violation of the United States Constitution, the United States laws, the laws of the several states. This is also a violation of the United Nations Charter, as well as the laws of war. This is a affidavit that he sent to House Counsel Speaker Chuck Schumer, the Minority Leader McConnell. And as such, this is a notice that it must cease and desist the civilian thing using American weapons for failure to cease and desist, continuing crime.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Scott's doing a superb job there. Continuing, Blinken has told Netanyahu the U.S. will remove all limits on arms shipment to Israel. In other words, we'll give them any weapons they want. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reportedly promised Israeli PM Netanyahu that America will soon remove all restrictions on weapon transfers to Israel. From TikTok, I come before you, not only as a U.S. Secretary of State, but also as a Jew. My grandfather fled pogroms. My stepfather survived concentration camps, so I understand the harrowing echoes that Hamas massacres carry for Jews everywhere. Frankly, this is an absurd statement on many counts. The slaughters and massacres are being conducted by the Israelis against the Palestinians, not by Hamas against the Jews. And he actually claimed his stepfather had survived three different concentration camps, which is prima facie evidence that the Holocaust story is a hoax, because if they're death camps, where you're unloaded from cattle cars, stripped naked, put into chambers and gassed to death, how could he evade it three different times? The story, of course, is a fraud. From the Times of Israel. During their meeting last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken promised PM Benjamin Netanyahu Washington will, in the coming days, remove all restrictions on weapon transfers to the Jewish state. The UNSCAR's report says Netanyahu demanded renewal of the same level of arms shipments as at the start of the war, lamenting the U.S. has, in practice, halted its military support for the war against Hamas in Gaza. Of course, that's just a euphemism. It's not a war against Hamas in Gaza. It's a genocide of the Palestinian people. And that the UN, United States, is supporting it is outrageous. Netanyahu reportedly warned the slowing of aid plays into the hands of Iran and its proxies, extends the war and increases the risk, broadening to new fronts. After Blinken's pledge, Netanyahu told Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer, and National Security Advisor Chashi Hanuga to make sure the armed transfers have been renewed during upcoming meetings with American officials. This means the U.S. will soon be sending Israel another shipment of 3,500-pound bombs, including 2,000-pound bunker busters, to drop on civilians in Gaza. Earlier this month, another State Department official publicly resigned because Blinken falsified a report to absolve Israel of responsibility for blocking humanitarian aid flows into Gaza and ensure U.S. weapons kept flowing to the Jewish state in violation of U.S. law. Here's Chris Minahan tweeting, the State Department under Antony Blinken falsified a report to absolve Israel of responsibility for blocking humanitarian aid flows into Gaza, the Guardian reports. The department's own experts were overruled. to ensure U.S. weapons keep flowing. Meanwhile, tension between Israel and Hezbollah stir U.S. fears of a wider conflict. A barrage of missiles this week, exchanged between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, have made U.S. officials increasingly concerned that the escalation could spiral the war-torn region into a broader conflict between the U.S. ally and the Iranian-backed militia. Since October 7th, the Biden admin has been furiously working behind the scenes to lower the chances of conflagration that could draw in the U.S. or put at further risk U.S. troops in the region, in Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. Amos Hochstein, a top diplomatic advisor to President Biden, is headed to Israel Monday to work on de-escalating the conflict, according to a U.S. official. That would have been yesterday. U.S. officials expressed concern about several scenarios. Some told CBS they interpreted the recent deeper strikes by Israel inside Lebanese territory as preparing the battlefield for a sweeping assault by Israeli defense forces. Hezbollah responded by launching large rocket attacks into Israel. These officials are increasingly concerned that Israel will start a war against Hezbollah in Lebanon that it cannot finish without American support. Other U.S. officials tell CBS their apprehension is focused on Hezbollah and describe a scenario in which the volume of the rocket strikes into Israel could result in unintended consequences that trigger an event Israel feels compelled to respond to, and which could then result in an unintended war. Inside Israel, the Hezbollah threat has become a potent political issue because many Israelis who evacuated their homes in the north of the country remain displaced. Following the October 7 attack by Hamas in Israel and launching the war in Gaza, many residents of northern Israel and southern Lebanon left their homes out of concern they were living in an area that could soon become a battlefield. The increased tit-for-tat cross-border exchanges between Israel and Hezbollah make it harder for the U.S. to ease tensions in the region, particularly if the Biden admin's efforts to broker a hostage and ceasefire deal in Gaza founder. The administration views the ceasefire talks in Israel-Hezbollah tensions as intertwined. A senior Biden admin official told reporters in Italy Thursday, the most important thing about the hostage release and ceasefire deal that's on the table now is that if it's achieved, it can have an impact in the north of Israel. So that's an opportunity for us to be able to bring this conflict to a full close. The official also said that part of any ceasefire deal, there must be specific arrangements in Lebanon on the border. There has to be an agreement that allows Israelis to return to their homes in the north with security guarantees that it's not October 6th of Hezbollah sitting right on the blue line. The recent Israeli strike that targeted and killed Commander Taleb Abdullah, one of the highest-ranking members of Hezbollah, has triggered reprisals. Public events mourning Abdullah are expected in the coming days. Unlike the surprise attack by Hamas in October, a possible war with Hezbollah in Lebanon is something the Israeli military has been gaming out for years, according to U.S. officials. Meanwhile, Biden deploys a record number of troops to Jordan in a quiet buildup. As the war in Gaza rages, the Biden admin has deployed a record number of U.S. troops to Jordan, a new report to Congress reveals. The troop buildup has not been previously reported. There are now a record 3,813 American troops in Jordan, according to the White House War Powers Report to Congress released on June 7. That's a 625-troop increase over December, with a number of soldiers and airmen exceeding the number at any time since the second Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq, a review of past war power reports reveals. The Biden admin has sought to keep quiet its close military ties to Jordan, with the White House National Security Council instructing State Department communication officials to avoid mentioning its military coordination with the country. In particular, according to internal memos I've reviewed, when Iran fired missiles and drones at Israel in April, Jordan was a key partner in shooting them down. And Jordan even allowed Israeli planes to operate in Jordanian airspace. Jordan is a partner of Israel, is a particularly sensitive issue. Hence the desire on the part of Washington to keep talk of Jordan to a minimum. I would suggest the buildup of U.S. troops in Jordan is to provide the kind of support Netanyahu has asked for, to wit, American troop to attack Hezbollah, exemplifying the closeness of U.S. and Jordanian military relations. Last month, U.S. CENTCOM conducted one of the largest joint military exercises in the Middle East in Jordan, called Eager Lion. Despite its significance, the Pentagon scarcely mentioned it, with Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh referencing it just once during a May 16th press briefing. Her remarks made no mention of the uptick in attacks from Iran-backed groups, instead relying on the same sort of euphemism that appeared in the admin's war powers report, citing regional security. While the Pentagon provided a breakdown of the number of U.S. troops participating in the 2022 iteration of Eager Lion in a press release, no such breakdown is included in the equivalent press release from last month. If possible, the increase in U.S. troops in Jordan is an attempt to compensate for the drawdown of U.S. combat personnel in Iraq, following pressure from the Iraqi government for their withdrawal, or, as I suggest, positioning U.S. troops to attack Hezbollah, which I dare say would not have a happy ending for the United States. Hezbollah is a serious military force. American troops today, alas, are not. Meanwhile, Netanyahu demands White House give him tools to finish the job in Gaza. That means to complete the genocide. Israeli PM Netanyahu published a scathing video blasting the White House for holding back weapon shipments to Israel. Washington has blocked one transfer of 2,000-pound bombs, has overwhelmingly provided all the arms requested by Tel Aviv. A PM demanded the U.S. supply the tools Israel needs to finish the job a lot faster in the Gaza Strip, virtually echoing the complaints of Donald Trump that they had to finish the job, but they had to do it quickly. Tuesday, Netanyahu posted the video on his X account. Speaking in English, a PM said, "When Secretary Blinken was here recently in Israel, we had a candid conversation. I said I deeply appreciate the support the U.S. has given Israel from the beginning of the war. I also said something else. I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration had been withholding weapons and ammunition from Israel." Breaking. PM Netanyahu released a video in English where he attacked the American admin for not releasing a shipment of weapons to Israel. In late April, the White House decided it would suspend a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs over concerns about civilian deaths in Gaza. However, President Biden suggested he would cut off additional arms transfers if Israeli forces proceeded with a full-scale invasion of Rafah. Over a month after that assault began, Biden has failed to follow through on his supposed red line. According to Netanyahu, The White House will likely reverse course on its vow to scale back this military aid. Secretary Blinken assured me the admin is working day and night to remove those blocks. I certainly hope that is the case. It should be the case. Israeli leader concluded his message, demanding Biden remove all restrictions on weapons so he could quickly wrap up operation in Gaza. In World War II, Churchill told the United States, give us the tools and we'll do the job. And I say, give us the tools and we'll finish the job a lot faster. Throughout the latest conflict with Hamas, top Israeli officials have repeatedly invoked Allied war crimes committed during the Second World War in cities like Dresden, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki to justify the onslaught in Gaza. Here he is.
When Secretary Blinken was recently here in Israel, we had a candid conversation. I said I deeply appreciated the support the U.S. has given Israel from the beginning of the war. But I also said something else. I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration has been withholding weapons and ammunition to Israel. Israel, America's closest ally, fighting for its life, fighting against Iran and our other common enemies. Secretary Blinken assured me that the administration is working day and night to remove these bottlenecks. I certainly hope that's the case. It should be the case. During World War II, Churchill told the United States, give us the tools, we'll do the job. And I say, give us the tools and we'll finish the job a lot faster.
Yes, they'll slaughter the Palestinians a whole lot faster. Meanwhile, the Israeli army and intel knew of the plan of October 7th. The number of Israeli captured in the operation was very close to the number predicted in the just-revealed document, according to the Palestinian Chronicle staff, a document prepared by the Gaza Division of the Israeli Army. It already warned that the Palestinian group Hamas was preparing to launch an attack on Israel with the purpose of capturing 200 to 250 Israelis. The official Israeli Broadcasting Corporation, KAN, revealed on Monday. The news of the document, which is also reported by Al Jazeera, detailed a planned hostage-taking process by Hamas, quoting an Israeli security source as saying the document was also known to Israeli intelligence, at least within the Gaza Division command, Al Jazeera reported. According to the Arabic News Channel website, Israel's Khan TV said the document was prepared by the Gaza Division last September, shortly before Palestinian fighters attacked southern Israeli military bases and settlements, capturing many Israeli officers and settlers. The number captured in the operation was very close to the number predicted in the just revealed documents. Citing a previous report by the New York Times, published last January, Al Jazeera said that more than a year ago, the Israeli security establishment obtained a secret 40-page document called the Jericho Wall. The document further demonstrates a conflict within the Israeli ruling establishment regarding what transpired on October 7th. And what the Israeli army intelligence government knew or did not know about Hamas' plans. Despite this, last May, Israel Channel 12 said the general staff of the Israeli army had conducted an inspection of all military sites in the Gaza Division only 72 hours before the Hamas operation known as Al-Aqsa Flood. According to the channel, only one military site in the aftermath received low marks in terms of training and preparation. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for genocide against Palestinians, Israel has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7th. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 37,347 Palestinians have been killed, 85,372 wounded, in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, starting on October 7th. Moreover, At least 7,000 others are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Strip. Palestinian international organizations say the majority of those killed and wounded are women and children. The Israeli war has resulted in an acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. No doubt, I suspect, because the Israeli army knew what was going on. Israel's top court has suspended its October 7 probe. The Israeli High Court of Justice has ordered the government to halt its investigation into intelligence failings in the lead-up to Hamas' October 7th attack. The move comes after the court received classified briefings from security agencies, some of which have publicly exposed the probe. In an interim ruling Sunday, Justice Gilad Canfrey Steinitz paused the investigation until the court can hear arguments from its opponents next month. In view of the complex security reality, the planned scope of the investigation, which will deal, among other things, with combat support system and core operational issues, and the preparation required to respond to the investigation at the current time, I order the suspension of the investigative procedures in everything that relates to the IDF and Shin Bet, she wrote in her ruling, as quoted in Israeli media. Launched in December by State Controller Matthew Engelman, the probe sought to audit major security and intelligence failures ahead of Hamas' deadly attack last year, which was not stopped despite a number of warnings. However, the investigation faced opposition from a long line of top officials, among them Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The PM's cabinet secretary, Yossi Fuchs, attempted to stop the probe during an earlier meeting with Engelman, while Israeli Defense Force Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Heretz Halev, similarly urged the controller to hold off until the war in Gaza came to an end. The Army Chief reportedly told Engelman any external investigation would distract commanders and harm the ability and quality of the IDF's ongoing operational probe, as well as prevent implementing the lessons necessary to achieve war goals. In response, Engelman told Hevet that the severe failures that led to the events of October 7th required deep and fundamental examination, stressing that his team had been instructed to carry out the probe in a way that did not divert commanders' attention from the war. Several former defense officials have also opposed the intelligence audit, some of whom joined activist group Movement for Quality Government to petition the courts in February. The State Attorney General Office had publicly supported that effort, also arguing the probe would damage Israel's war effort. Attorney General Gali Barav-Mira likewise submitted a legal opinion to the High Court last month to make the same case. The MOG petition is what ultimately prompted Sunday's ruling. In addition to the October 7th intelligence failures, the IDF and other security agencies have faced pressure to investigate friendly fire incidents during the Hamas attack, including the shelling of a home full of Israeli hostages in a kibbutz near the Gaza border. The military said it opened a probe into the matter last winter and later cleared the commanders involved of any wrongdoing, no doubt. No wrongdoing there, nothing to see there, just move along. Meanwhile, right here in the USA, there's an ongoing effort led by the Anti-Defamation League, which can be viewed as the intellectual arm of the Mossad, for an immediate passage of the ADL-backed Countering Anti-Semitism Act, led by Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries. AIPAC funded House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries Friday, demanded Congress immediately pass the Anti-Defamation League backed Countering Anti-Semitism Act to silence criticism of Israel and police Americans' online speech. The dangerous explosion of anti-Semitic incidents in New York City and the nation requires decisive action at every level of government, Jeffries said on X, without referencing any specific incident. We have to crush this cancer with a fierce urgency of now. Congress must pass the bipartisan Countering Anti-Semitism Act immediately. Here's his tweet. The dangerous explosion of anti-Semitic incidents in New York City and the nation. These are primarily anti-genocide, pro-Palestine protests that Israel wants to suppress. Requires decisive action at every level of government. We have to crush this cancer with a fierce urgency of now. Congress must pass the bipartisan Countering Anti-Semitism Act immediately. Hakeem Jeffries, turns out, has collected 1.5 million from AIPAC and the Israeli lobby. Now he supports censorship bills trying to criminalize criticism of Israel. A representative is compromised. Hakeem Jeffries, the dangerous explosion. This bill would create a new national coordinator to counter anti-Semitism within the executive office of the president to, among other things, counter the spread of anti-Semitism online and its government-coerced censorship, including to impose accountability for individuals, journalist Michael Tracy noted on Hex. As I reported in April, the bill was introduced by a bipartisan pair of AIPAC-funded senators, Senator Jackie Rosen of Nevada, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, and championed by the ADL for its provisions aimed at stripping Americans of their free speech rights. The Countering Anti-Semitism Act is the most far-reaching anti-Semitism initiative to be introduced in Congress, ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt said on X in April. It offers a smart, bipartisan, whole-of-government, whole-of-society approach to combating the hatred and protecting Jews around the country when they don't need any protection. No one cares who the Jews are. It's not anti-Jewish. It's anti-genocide. It's against mass murder. Here's Jonathan Greenblatt. The Countering Anti-Semitism Act is the most far-reaching anti-Semitism initiative introduced in Congress. It offers a smart, bipartisan, whole-of-government, whole-of-society approach to combating this hatred and protecting Jews around the country who need no protection. This is clearly unconstitutional. I have no doubt that when this law, assuming it's passed, and because Congress is so dominating of our Congress, Israel is so dominating of our Congress, I have no doubt it will pass, is found to be unconstitutional and invalidated, all the mischief will have occurred in between. In addition, I have submitted a motion in relation to a legal case that I fought all the way to the United States Supreme Court to reopen the case pursuant to extrinsic fraud and fraud upon the court. Let me share this with you. It was filed yesterday, published today. Motion to open judgment pursuant to extrinsic fraud and fraud upon the court. Now comes James H. Fetzer, Ph.D., pro se, to open the judgment of $1.1 million in awards entered against him by extrinsic fraud and fraud upon the court practiced upon him. The extrinsic fraud was by FEMA, the media, and the Obama administration by presenting Exercise L-366 conducted on 12/13/12 as a real-time live mass shooting in which 20 children and 6 adults were killed. That is to say, it was presented as a live event the following day. A fraud upon the court was committed by officers of the court, including Leonard Posner's attorneys, Genevieve Zimmerman and Jacob Zimmerman, who separately and jointly perpetrated fraud upon the court by falsely alleging a death that did not occur and supporting perjury by presenting in support the deposition testimony of an imposter witness, and by Dane County Circuit Court Judge Frank Remington, who disallowed Dr. Fetzer from challenging the extrinsic fraud by setting aside his extensive and detailed evidence that a purported death had not occurred, but was based upon a staged event, which the mainstream media and the federal government had declared to be a real event to promote the government's gun control agenda, on the basis of which he granted summary judgment to plaintiff, Exhibit A, by sanctioning Dr. Fetzer when he sought to expose the identity of the imposter witness, thereby denying him a real contest in the hearing of case number 18-CV-3122, Posner v. Fetzer et al., and denying the existence of disputed facts when they were pervasive and fundamental to the case on appeal, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and even the United States Supreme Court, cert denied. And in support thereof, Dr. Fetzer states as follows, jurisdiction. 1. This case is brought under the rule announced in the case of United States versus Throckmorton of 1878 that fraud upon the court may be brought at any time in any court when a party has been prevented from presenting a valid defense. 2. It would be manifestly unconscionable for this decision to stand. Indeed, case number 18-CV-3122, Posner v. Fetzer et al., seemed to be a perfect example of fraud upon the court, as SCOTUS intended. Donald Griffin Jr., equitable relief from judgments obtained by fraud, intrinsic and extrinsic, of 1952. 3. It entails the violation of constitutional rights under color of law as defined under 18 U.S. Code 241 and 242 by denying Dr. Fetzer his 7th Amendment right to a trial by jury and his 14th Amendment right to equal protection because of summary judgment protocols of Wisconsin vary widely from those of other states, such as Texas. 5. And pursuant to the Wisconsin Code of Judicial Ethics, as set forth in Chapter 60 of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and Wisconsin Statute 806.072K, this section does not limit the power of a court to entertain an independent action to relieve a party from judgment, order, or proceeding, or to set aside a judgment for fraud on the court. Parties. James H. Fetzer, BHE plaintiff, resides at 800 Violet Lane, Oregon, Wisconsin, 53575. Leonard Posner, purported father of Noah Posner, who was present at the Sandy Hook crime scene, was photographed with his son prior to his son's alleged murder on December 14, 2012. That photograph has appeared worldwide. The last known Connecticut address for this Leonard Posner is 261 South Main Street, number 332, Newtown, Connecticut, 06470. See the picture published on the 2nd of May, 2017 in The Guardian in an article authored by Hadley Freeman. Attached here to is Exhibit B. Note this photograph is courtesy Leonard Posner. Here's a photograph published by The Guardian. Observe. Photograph courtesy Leonard Posner. And look at little Noah, who is highly telegenic. The youngest victim killed in the 2012 school massacre. His parent talks about dealing with the conspiracy theorists and hoaxers who have taunted him ever since. Well, take a look at the guy who appeared in court on the right, compared with another photograph of the Sandy Hook Posner figure eight. Age of Posners from the Sandy Hook shooting, December 12, 2012 left, versus May 29, 2019 right. According to the traffic ticket Posner received, his birth date is, meanwhile, his figure 24. A photograph of Noah Posner celebrating what appears to be his eighth birthday. Note the gate has eight candles on it. This is impossible if he died at the age of six. Meanwhile, there's a massive exhibit supporting my 26-page submission motion, which you can see elaborated here. More, they're very thorough, they're very extensive, and I believe settle the situation conclusively for both the existence of extrinsic fraud, including that we have drill L-366 on the Connecticut FEMA schedule, that we have the site activation call down drill exercise plan, that we have the affidavit of Brian Davidson, private investigator of the Newtown police files, showing not only no evidence of mass murder, but proof it was not even an operating school. FBI consolidated crime report of 2012 showing at the intersection of murder or non-negligent homicide for Newtown during 2012, the number zero. And we have the affidavit of Wolfgang Halbig about an individual who appeared in his court case who just happened to have a speeding ticket. My own affidavit that the party he's identified as was a witness in my case in Madison. The affidavit of Brian Davidson, PI, especially exhibit Y, showing that there are two different Leonard Posners and that the Posner who testified in my case is not the same as the crime scene Posner, which I've already illustrated, but for which there is massive additional evidence. Finally, my affidavit. I, James Fetzer, PhD, pro se, affirm that my motion to open judgment pursuant to extrinsic fraud and fraud upon the court is being brought in good faith and substantiated by voluminous and detailed documentation submitted as exhibits A through Z. Let me just add, I would like to believe that the Wisconsin courts are going to clean up this mess, because it has dragged out for years. I've invested close to 12 months in preparing this case, which I've now submitted. Let us hope that justice will finally prevail. I conclude by extending our best wishes to Scott Bennett for his safety, security, and return to join us on this program, hopefully as early as next week. Meanwhile, I thank him for this opportunity to share these latest developments with you. Thank you to Global TV.